short outline of my talk. I will first give some reasons why we are not happy with the standard model as it is. And then I will consider some possible hints at physics beyond the standard model. Then I will introduce string theory as an ultraviolet completion of Grand unified theories in extra dimensions. And finally, I will show some MSSM-like theories which we derived from strings. So the standard model is characterized by its gauge group, SU3 color cross, SU2 weak cross, U1 hypercharge, and the following particle content here. And usually when string theorists say standard model, they mean the MSSM. So that's why I have two Higgs doublets here. And these are actually superfields. Yeah? So on the next following slides, the standard model is the usual standard model, but after five slides, it will be the MSSM. So I'm using these terms synonymously. So one of the reasons why we are not very happy with the standard model is that there are too many free parameters. If we take into account the new developments in the neutrino sector, we have at least 26 parameters and possibly two more phases if the neutrinos are Majorana. Then the structure of the gauge symmetry, we can ask the question, why are there three different gauge coupling constants? Why is the gauge group a direct product of simple gauge group factors? Also, the structure of Fermi multiplets is unexplained, so it would be much nicer if we could fit all these representations of quarks and leptons in a single representation. The repetition of families is unexplained, so everything we see around us, neutrons and protons, are made up entirely of the first family, and we do not know why the second and third families replicated. The texture of Yukawa couplings is unexplained. So this is the Yukawa matrix in the quark sector, and for theoretical purposes, this matrix is almost diagonal. So we do not know why this matrix is diagonal. And also, we do not know why the first two families are so much lighter than the third family. And if you look at the corresponding CKM matrix in the lepton sector, this matrix is as non-diagonal as it can be. So it's in some sense maximally non-diagonal. And also, the neutrinos are extremely light. Then there is the famous hierarchy problem. So if we look at the only not discovered particle in the standard model, the Higgs particle, which is a scalar particle, it receives large corrections to its mass. And if these corrections are actually quadratic in the cutoff scale, where we expect some fundamental physics, and if this cutoff scale is too high, there are problems with the stability of the vacuum. And also in the context of the standard model, if we renormalize it, it requires an incredible fine-tuning to set things right. So another way to put it, why are there two fundamental mass scales at all? Then from cosmology, we know that there is dark matter. 23% of the energy content of the universe is actually dark matter, and the standard model offers no candidate. And 73% of the universe is made up of dark energy. And the cosmological constant as predicted by quantum field theories is the worst predicted quantity in particle physics at all. I will not address this question in the talk, so I'm just listing some of the shortcomings of the standard model. Then there is gravity. At scales which are relevant in everyday life, Newton's theory works fine. And if you look at the solar system and satellites and the moon, etc., we are still in the regime where Newton's theory is valid. But at cosmological scales, we need Einstein's theory of general relativity. And if you go to very, very small scales, we need a quantum theory of gravitation, which we do not have as yet. So there are many other problems which I'm not mentioning, but these are some of the highlights why we are not so happy with the standard model. Now, if we look at possible physics beyond the standard model, we can ask, are there any hints? And one of the hints is that if we look at the gauge couplings at our energies, at the electroweak scale, and if we use the renormalization group equations to run them to higher energies, these couplings seem to meet at one point. And this could be indicative of one gauge coupling and one gauge group at a high energy. So unfortunately, if we look more precisely, it turns out that the gauge couplings miss each other and do not unify. But if we, you know, introduce supersymmetry with superpartner masses around one TeV, then it turns out that the gauge couplings unify between the theoretical and experimental uncertainties. And I take this to be a strong motivation both for grand unified theories and for supersymmetry. Now there is a second reason why we favor supersymmetry, namely the mentioned hierarchy problem can be solved, at least in a technical sense. This is a standard model graph which gives the mass correction to the Higgs particle, and there are two graphs in a supersymmetric case, and this is one of them, which is a quadratic divergence, and it turns out that in supersymmetry the quadratic divergence is exactly cancelled. And this is a technical solution to the hierarchy problem, so the dependence of the mass on the cutoff scale is not quadratic any longer, but it's logarithmic, so it's very mild in the energy. But still, we can ask the question, why are there two different mass scales in the theory, like the electroweak scale and the more fundamental scale, be it the grand unified scale or the string scale or something else. So in this sense, it's a technical solution to the hierarchy problem. So if we now assume that there is a grand unified gauge group at energies around 3 times 10 to the 16, then we need at least two things for this gauge group to satisfy. Namely, for one thing, it must be big enough to include the standard model gauge symmetry, and because we want to make some predictions, this gauge group should be minimal otherwise. And by minimal, I mean a rank 4 gauge group, a rank 4 Lie algebra. And rank 4 means that there are 4 diagonal commuting operators. So all the Lie algebras have been classified. That's the Cartan-Killing classification, and these are the classical Lie algebras, and these are the exceptional ones. And I can take a look at all the rank 4 Lie algebras, and it turns out the first two I can immediately exclude because they do not contain SU3 as a subset. The next one I can exclude because it turns out that if we take one of the SU3s to be SU3 color, we have to embed hypercharge in the second SU3 and gives wrong prediction for the hypercharge of the quarks. And the next gauge groups I can actually exclude because there are no complex representations, so I cannot accommodate antiparticles. So for the antiparticles, I need the complex representations. And thus, SU5 is a unique candidate in the case that we have only rank 4 algebras. Now, minimal SU5 is very predictive, but unfortunately it also suffers from some problems, and I will mention some of these problems later in the talk. So this is the reason why we need to introduce some extra degrees of freedom into the theory. So what I will do now is I will ask the question, what are the next to minimal algebras? And I'm just imposing two priors. I say that I will prefer simple Lie algebras, and I use the word simple in a mathematical sense, so I do not want the Lie algebra to be a direct product of more than one factor. And also, the gauge group clearly must have some complex representations to accommodate for the antiparticles. So it turns out that our only choices are SUn for n greater than or equal to 5, so SU5, SU6, SU7. It is SO4n plus 2, so SO10, SO14, SO18, it goes in steps of 4s, and E6. So let us have a look at SO10. It turns out that SO10 breaks to, we can break SO10 to SU5 cross 1 extra U1. And this SU5 can be broken to the standard model gauge symmetry. And it is a very intriguing fact that actually the 16, the spinner representation of SO10, goes to 10 plus 5 bar plus 1. And when we break it to the standard model, all the particles, all the quarks and leptons of one generation neatly fit into exactly one generation of SO10. So whereas we need 3 representations in the case of SU5, we can fit one generation of particles into one single representation of SO10. So that's the reason why I favor SO10. So we can also compare the predictions which we get from SU5 and SO10, and this comparison is subjective, so everybody may disagree as he likes. So it's in some sense a very personal assessment. So if you look at gauge coupling unification, then it is fair to say that both theories predict gauge coupling unification because there is one gauge group at the high energies. If we look at the quarks and leptons, it turns out that in the case of SU5, I need at least 3 representations to accommodate the particles, and in SO10 I I can use just one representation. When it comes to the quantization of electric charge, SU5 has an advantage, because if you break SU5 down to the SU3 cross SU2, you get exactly one direction, one abelian U1, which can be taken to be hypercharged. So only the overall normalization is not fixed, but in some sense the hypercharge prediction is very clear in this case. In SO10, I give a so-la-la, because if you break SO10 down to the symmetry of the standard model, you get two U1s. And hypercharge can be any linear combination of these two U1s. So whatever you get, it will still be quantized, but you know, you do not really predict that, for example, right-handed up quark singlet should have hypercharge minus 4 thirds. Yeah? That's a prediction which is in SU5, but not necessarily in SU10. Sine squared theta Weinberg is in good agreement with experiment in the case of SU5. I gave a solar law for SO10 because of the reason I mentioned before, hypercharge is a linear combination, and we have to make a choice. If we look at one of the other predictions of grand unified theories, m bottom over m tau can be predicted, and SU5 and SO10 predict a viable relation for the case of the third family, but unfortunately for the first and second family, this prediction is completely wrong. So I gave a solar law for both theories. The right-handed neutrino, in the case of SU5, it can be put in by hand, but it's a clear prediction in the case of SO10, so it's a thumbs up for SO10. And the smallest of neutrino masses, once you have a right-handed neutrino, you can use the CISO mechanism. So I also think that for SO10, SO10 is an advantage in this case. So in SU5, you can implement it, so I gave a solar law for SU5. So why are we not so happy with traditional grand unified theories in four dimensions? So the problem is that the gauge symmetry, let's say SU5, has still to be broken down to the gauge symmetry of the standard model. And to do that, you need the adjoint representation of SU5. And you would be requiring, you would be predicting many more particles. And also, if you want to have realistic fermion mass matrices, so if you want to avoid the prediction of m bottom over m tau for the first and second family, you need a 45-dimensional representation of SU5, and this gives even more particles. And the other big problem for traditional grand unification is that the Higgs particle is, in the case of SU5, it is in the 5 and 5 bar representations. In the case of SO10, it is in the 10. And if you break it down to the symmetry of the standard model, you are not only predicting the H up and the H down, but you are also predicting color triplet partners of these Higgses. And these color triplet partners mediate proton decay. And actually, it turns out that both of these problems can be avoided if you go to extra dimensions. So I will consider a quantum field theory in 6 dimensions. So in the end, we want to take the full step and go to string theory in 10 dimensions. But because it is easier to explain, I'm considering a toy theory in 6 dimensions. So if the quantum field theory lives in 6 dimensions and we are observing only 4 dimensions, 2 of the dimensions have to be compactified. They have to be made so small that we cannot probe them. And usually people say, okay, then we compactify them on a torus. And a torus is nothing else than the plane on which you put a mesh, a grid, given by 2 basis vectors, this one here, which ends at the 1 here on the x-axis, and this one here. And I say the torus is given by the fact that you take the plane and identify all particles which differ by a linear integral, by an integral linear combination of these 2 basis vectors. So what does that mean? For example, if I am somewhere in the plane, let's say at this point, then I can walk back using this basis vector. I can walk back 1, 2, 3, and it turns out that I am in the torus, in the fundamental domain of the torus. So I can take any point in the plane and walk back into the shaded area. And it turns out that this edge here is identified with this edge here. This edge here is identified with this edge here. So you have to glue it like this and like this, and topologically you get a torus. Okay? So that is how I define the torus. The tau parameter is not completely useless. I mean, you would say, for example, if you take any mesh, you will always get a topological torus, that's true. But some of the properties of the torus, like complex differentiability, depend on the tau. So it depends on the angle of the 2 basis vectors, etc. So some of the properties depend on your specific choice, how you put the grid on the plane. It turns out to break the symmetry, we need an additional symmetry which we impose on top of the torus identification. So in string theory, this identification is in some sense, in string theory we use this identification to reduce an n equal to 4 theory to an n equal to 1 theory. And in field theory constructions, it's usually used to break the symmetry. So what does this Z2 do? The Z2 can be anything which squares to identity. So think about it like a reflection at the origin. So for example, this point can be reflected here. Or it can also be a 180-degree rotation. So anything which squares to identity qualifies. And if I impose a Z2 action, it turns out that the fundamental domain of the torus is halved, and I just get this red shaded area. And it turns out that this edge here has to be identified with this edge. This edge here has to be identified with this edge here. And this top edge has to be identified with this bottom edge. So if I just take this and flip it over, I get the topology of a pillow. Okay? So in some sense, what I'm proposing is, I say the compact dimensions are not a torus, not a donut, but it's rather a cushion. Yeah? And so I used a translation in space-time to define the torus, and on top of it, a rotation to define what I called an orbifold. And it turns out that in field theory, it is convenient to associate a phase with these operations in the gauge degrees of freedom. In string theory, it is forced upon you. So in string theory, you don't have the choice. There is a concept called modular invariance, which forces you to associate a phase in a gauge degrees of freedom with whatever rotation or translation you do in a space-time degrees of freedom. And I will try to explain that at hand of a simple example. So let's take, as an example, a theory where there is an SO10 living in a bulk. So bulk means everything. Yeah, bulk is always everything, six dimensions. And let's consider a fixed point at the origin. Why do I call it a fixed point? If I rotate this point by 180 degrees, it just stays where it is. So that is why I call it a fixed point. And this equation here just states the same. Theta F1 is equal to F1. And now I can say, okay, I choose a vector V, capital V, such that for every gauge degree of freedom alpha, this could be anything. For example, you know, the highest weight in Dunkin labels or Katan-Weil labels, anything which characterizes the representation, I say this capital V acts on such a way to give exactly this phase on the gauge degrees of freedom. Yeah, I can do that. And if, for the sake of argument, in this model I say V should be identically equal to zero, it turns out that this does not place any restrictions, and I get the full SO10 symmetry surviving at the origin. So the reason why I took this simple example is I'm trying to mimic an existing model in the literature. So let's make it a little bit more complicated. Let's consider the fixed point which is here. So this is also a fixed point. If you rotate it by 180 degrees, you are here. But this point is the same point on the torus, because remember, we are not on the plane, we are on the torus, which means that this point has to be identified by shifting it back by E5. So this point is actually fixed also. It is also a fixed point. This is just the equation. So rotating it and shifting it back with E5 gives us the same point. And now I say, okay, this capital V I associated with the rotation theta, and I can also associate a phase A5 times alpha I with this translation E5 defining the torus. So if I now make a judicious choice of A5, then I can, for example, have 21 of the alpha survive, and it turns out that I have the partisan gauge symmetry. This is just schematic, yeah. But this is how it works. This is how one breaks the symmetry using the extra dimensions, using Wilson lines and not using, for example, large X representation. I call this A5 a Wilson line because it actually corresponds to a phase associated with a non-contractible cycle. So if you look at this E5, if you walk from here to here, following E5, on the torus, you are walking along one of the cycles. Yeah. So what you are doing is you are associating a phase with one of the cycles, and this is what field theorists call a Wilson line.
So no additional constraints arise from doing the same thing to any of the other points?
They are not independent, yeah. You mean,
okay,
for example, if I do it here?
Well, if you go back to the previous picture, you could... Oh, I see. You always want to rotate around the origin, you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
if
also
you
this...
That, and if you considered some of the other points on the square, you wouldn't get any independent conditions from that?
I get an independent condition from here, but this one is dependent.
Okay, and so does that independent condition from the upper point further break the symmetry or no?
That's a subtle issue. I mean, it depends. I mean, like, at the fixed point where you are, the symmetry breaking is independent of the other fixed points. But if you go down in dimensions, if you say, what does it look like from our four-dimensional point of view, it turns out we see the intersection of all the symmetries.
Yeah.
So we apply all of them at the same time. So that is how I get the standard model. I will explain in the next transparency. So it turns out that we can play the same game again. So I showed you how to get the Patisalam at this fixed point. It turns out that, you know, you can make another choice for a Wilson line in this direction. You get Georgian-Glashow SU5. And this fixed point here will not be independent, the symmetry breaking, but it turns out that you get flipped SU5. Now, there are four gauge groups at the fixed point living in the extra dimensions. But in four dimensions, so if we, from our point of view, this torus is shrunk to a point, yeah? So we see the interaction of all these four gauge groups, and it turns out that the intersection of these gauge groups is exactly the standard model. And this also, so what we have done is we have broken, for example, SO10 down to the symmetry of the standard model without Higgs representations. And also what we have done is, one of the advantages of this construction is we could now, for example, judiciously place the fields in the extra dimensions and use it to generate semi-realistic fermion masses. I could, for example, put one of the particles into the bulk and say the Higgs also lives there. There is a maximal overlap of the wave functions. This is why the mass of this particle will be higher. And I can say it's a top quark, and the others I just place in a way so that, you know, I can play with the masses. That is how people address the question of fermion masses in this context. And also it turns out, I have not shown, but the same Z2 which breaks the symmetry can also be used to project out parts of the Higgs which lives in the 10, so that you can project out the triplet Higgses but keep the 1.2 Higgses. So this solves the doublet-triplet splitting problem. So why are we interested in taking this step to 10 dimensions? The field theory orbifolds suffer from a number of shortcomings, and one of them is that if you go up in dimensions, the theories become more and more non-renormalizable. So take, for example, dimensional regularization, and then you see everything diverges to over epsilon when epsilon goes to 0, so dimension goes to 4. And it's somehow clear that if you go up in dimensions, this becomes worse and worse. Yeah, the higher you go in dimension, the more non-renormalizable theory becomes. And also, the number of dimensions is arbitrary in the case of field theory constructions. So there are models in 5 dimensions, there are models in 6 dimensions. It is not clear what the dimensionality of space-time should be. Also, the symmetry breaking pattern is arbitrary. So I could choose the V's and the A's just as I like. The placement of the fields is arbitrary. So I can put them on the brain, I can put them in the bulk, there is no organizing principle. And the advantages of Stringer orbifolds are that, for one thing, they are finite, and thus they do not need normal renormalization. And also they predict the space-time dimensions, so we predict that there are 10 space-time dimensions. And the symmetry in 10 dimensions in the bulk, so what was SO10 in the previous example, is either E8 cross E8 or SO32, so for a heterotic orbifold. So in some sense, we always start with one gauge symmetry in 10 dimensions. There is no choice. The spectrum and localization of particles is predicted. As soon as you specify how you want to break the symmetry, then the theory gives you the particles in the theory and also their localization. So we cannot play around with it, but it's predicted. I mean, good or bad, it's predicted and fixed. And also because it's a string construction, it includes a quantum theory of gravity.
I guess I don't understand the next to the last point. Can you say a little bit more about how the spectrum and localization of the particles is predicted?
Actually, I cannot because I removed all the technical details from the talk. So,
okay, just in words.
So, in words, okay. So, what one does is, in string theory, first one solves the mass equation. So, we want to look at the mass spectrum. So, what you're doing is you're solving, so you're solving a quadratic equation on a lattice, on the E8 cross E8 lattice. And after you do that, you ask the question, are these particles invariant under the operations defining the orbifold? Some of them are projected out and others are not. And also, you know, the Wilson lines, which I have called A's, they actually enter the mass equation. Oops. These A's, just a second. Okay, it's not in the picture. These A's also enter the mass equation, which means that which particles survive at different fixed points is given by the choice of the A5s. So there is a difference. I mean, not every particle can live at every fixed point. The Wilson lines distinguish them. So everything is calculable.
I see. So, but all the particles do have to live at one fixed point or the other, is that
yes.
What you're saying?
Well, unless there is a so-called fixed torus, then they can, sometimes they are free to move in an extra dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there are six-dimensional modes, but they have to live either at a fixed point or on a fixed torus. I closed this program. Just a second. Shall I try to? Oh no, I do not.
Yeah, just continue.
Okay. So let us take a look at the orbifolds in 10 dimensions. So my starting point is the heterotic string in 10 dimensions with the gauge group E8 cross E8, and it is a theory with n equal to 1 supersymmetry in 10 dimensions. So in the following, I will never touch 4-dimensional Minkowski space, and if I do not touch 4-dimensional Minkowski space, I have 6 extra dimensions which I have to compactify, and for the sake of simplicity, I've just drawn the case of, you know, 3 2 tori. But it could be anything. It could also be, for example, 1 5 torus and 1 circle. It could be 1 4 torus and 1 2 torus, as long as the dimensions add up to 6. And it turns out that if you compactify string theory on a 6 torus, that you predict 4 supersymmetries in 4 dimensions, and this is unphysical. So this is the reason, that's actually the original motivation for people to consider orbifolding. They considered it to reduce the number of supersymmetries. So when you impose the extra discrete symmetry, which in our example was a Z2, it turns out it kills a number of supersymmetries and lets only one survive in 4 dimensions. So this was the original motivation. Now, the first thing you may ask is, okay, but how do I choose the compactification lattice? How do I choose the torus? And the first thing we know is that the symmetry which we are modding out, the Z2, the Z3, or whatever, must be an automorphism of the lattice defining a 6 torus. If it is not, we cannot consistently define a geometric object by modding out. Yeah? And in 3 dimensions, this is a familiar concept, so there are 219 crystallographic space groups. It turns out that the corresponding quantity in 6 dimensions is 28,927,922. It's a huge number, and we cannot cope with it, not even with computers. So we put in a physical demand, so we require that the twists, the discrete symmetry, be a subset of SU3. This corresponds to requiring SU3 holonomy, which gives us n equal to 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So this is something which we must have. But also, for simplicity, we restrict ourselves to abelian point groups, so to Zn's. This is not requirement does not arise from physics, but it arises from simplicity. Yeah? So this could be generalized, and actually there are non-abelian orbifolds in literature, but they're extremely complicated. So once we require these, it turns out that we have a finite list, and this it is. And much of the model building effort was concentrated on the Z3 orbifolds. So sometimes when you hear statements like that orbifolds were popular at in the late 1980s, usually what people mean is that everything related to Z3 and Z7 has been done. The other orbifolds have not been looked at. So actually there is no phenomenology done with the other more complicated orbifolds. This has only been done since recently. So the case of Z4, Choi, Kurt Nibbeling, and Trabletti were working on the Z4 orbifold in the context of the SO32 heterotrix thing. So Kobayashi, Rabi, Zhang started looking at the Z6 orbifold in 2004. We did some work when I was a PhD student in Bonn. We did some work on the Z2 cross Z2 orbifold. And at the moment, together with Stuart Rabi, we are looking at the Z2 cross Z4 orbifolds out of reasons, which I will explain in the conclusions. And Professor Ginny Kim and collaborators are looking at the Z12 orbifold. So in some sense, he jumped to the end of the list, whereas we are working our way through the smaller ones first. And for the remainder of this talk, I will concentrate on the Z62 orbifold. So the first thing I have to explain is what is my choice for the geometry. So my choice of the geometry is the product. I choose the compact dimensions to be the product of three two-dimensional tori. And each torus is given by the root lattice of a simple Lie algebra. So this is the G2 root lattice, this one is the SO3 root lattice, and this one is the SO4 root lattice. There are different choices for the torus. So once you fix the symmetry to be, for example, Z6, there are still different tori on which this Z6 can act on. Yeah. So choosing a torus is a very specific choice. And this choice also influences some of the physical properties of the model. And it turns out that what I called shift, the capital V, the gauge embedding of the rotation, in the case of the Z62, there are 61 different choices. Now you will say this is still a large number, but it is much, much smaller than the choice you would have if you had not any restrictions from string theory. So I mean, the gauge group is E8 cross E8, and you're looking at all the ways for breaking down E8, I mean the first E8, and independently the second E8. Yeah? There are many, many choices. I mean, and not only the 112, which is in this famous article by Hollywood and Myhill. I mean, they actually classified the Y reflections in the lattice and not the breakings. But it's a lower bound in some sense. You have at least 112 squared. Yeah? And in string theory, you have 61 choices which are consistent with modular invariance. It's a concept I cannot explain, but it is, it's a stringy constraint. And also, on top of the symmetry breakdown, you have the choice to choose this Wilson line here in the second torus, A3, and also this Wilson line here in the last torus. And it turns out that for the Wilson lines, you have thousands of choices which are consistent, so we need some guidelines. And here I am now adding my phenomenological priors. So I am saying that, okay, our starting point is the E8, and because I argued earlier so much in favor of SO10, I will require that there be an SO10 after the initial symmetry breakdown. So this is one of my priors. I mean, I need not do that. Maybe an E6 is good enough, maybe an SO14 is good enough. Yeah? It is a phenomenological prior which I put in. And it turns out that of the 61 shifts, I'm left with 15. And also what I'm doing is I'm demanding that if I have the spinner representation of SO10, that none of these particles which live here are projected out. So it could be that I get the wrong doublet-triplet fitting. I mean, doublet-triplet fitting is supposed to project out the triplets and leave us the 1,2s, but in some sense it also works on a 16, and it could be that it projects out parts of the 16-plet. And this is not what I want to do. So if I say that the 16-plet should survive as a full multiplet, then I'm left with just two shifts. So this reduces the number from 61 to 2. And just to show you that actually most of the recent orbifold publications have concentrated on only these two shifts. Yeah. So these are the results of our recent paper, and I want to walk you through this list in detail. And I want you to ignore the last three columns. So we considered also the case if we had an E6 after the initial breakdown, but these models are reduced to zero quite fast. So SO10-1 and SO10-2 are the shifts V22 and V56 from the earlier transparency. Yeah, these are exactly two shifts which I isolated.
So just to get a more, so the V22, for example, can you say a little bit more about what that 22 refers to?
It is in my PhD, it is, I numbered them from 1 to 61.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 20-second shift. That's just a number.
Okay.
It is just, it has no meaning. It is just a numbering.
So
it is
not
just
a double index.
No, it's,
yeah,
not,
it's
not a double
index.
No,
okay.
No, no.
Okay.
It goes from V1 to V50, from V1
okay.
to V61, and that's a 20-second shift.
All
right. Now, I should go over the talk and make it maybe consistent notation, but, you know. Oops. Okay. So let me explain first the first line. So first, we generate all the models which exist with two Wilson lines. And what do I mean by that? So the starting point is the E8 cross E8 prime. And the prime just means, you know, it's just used to distinguish the second E8 from the E8, from the first E8. It has no significance. And I'm considering the case where I say I have the shift V22. And the shift V22 breaks E8 cross E8 prime down to SO10 cross SU2 squared cross U1 cross SO14 prime cross U1 prime. Okay? And now what I'm doing is I'm switching on all the possible order 3 Wilson lines, A3, and I'm switching on all the possible order 2 Wilson lines, A2, and I'll end up with 22,000 models, 22,000 different models. And in this context, I must specify what I mean by different. So I call two models equivalent if they are four-dimensional spectra coincide. So if the models have 5 left-handed quark doublets and, you know, 7 right-handed up quarks and 122 right-handed neutrinos, the same numbers, I call these two models equivalent. You may think that is a good concept of defining equivalence. Unfortunately, it turns out it is not, because the fields can differ in the localization in the extra dimensions. And this may influence properties like Yukawa couplings, etc. So what we have done is we are not paying attention to these subtleties at the moment. We have identified all these models which may differ in the extra dimensions. In the second point, I demand that you know, all these models will not necessarily have the standard model gauge symmetry. I will then ask, okay, how many of these models have the standard model gauge symmetry? And I'm being more specific. I'm asking these models to have the standard model gauge symmetry which lives in an SU5 subset in the SO10 after the initial symmetry breaking. So if I find the SU3 cross SU2, but it is a subset of another, you know, if it is not in the SO10, I just ignore these models. Ah, yeah, okay, that's what I said in words. So what I do is I look up whether I really end up with SU3 cross SU2, and I demand that this SU3 cross SU2 is in the SO10 which lives in the first E8. And then I end up with 3,563 models. In the next step, I ask, in which cases do I have 3 net 3,2s? So actually, this number coincides with the number of pre-generation models. At the moment, we do not know yet what hypercharge is. I will introduce hypercharge in a moment. So at the moment, we cannot distinguish between, for example, the right-handed up quark and the right-handed down quark. Yeah? Let's take a typical string spectrum, for example, this one. And the first thing I want to draw your attention to is that this spectrum factorizes. So, for example, these particles are candidates for a left-handed quark doublet. It is a 3,2 representation. And it has no charge under the gauge group, which I will call hidden. It has no charge under SU5 prime. And if I look at the particles which have some charge under the SU5 prime, which transform under this SU5 prime, they are singlet representations under the standard model. Which means that, as far as the non-abelian gauge groups are concerned, these two sectors don't talk to each other. So this is why I call this a hidden sector. And now it turns out that I can actually pair up the extra particles and end up with the particle content of the standard model. So for example, here I have exactly the number I want, 3, 3,2, that's fine. But here I have too many. I want 6 of them, not 12. So I just write in a more suggestive way. I write the 12 tribarkoma ones as 6 tribarkoma ones plus 6 tribarkoma ones, and I have 6 trichoma ones. And now I can couple these two particles with each other and write a gauge invariant mass term in front of it and make them heavy. Yeah? In string theory, it turns out that there are restrictions on these Yukawa couplings, but in field theory, I mean, gauge invariance is enough. If I have a particle and it's charge conjugate particle, I can write in front of it a gauge invariant mass. It's an allowed interaction. And typically, this mass will be very high because the gauge symmetry is not protecting its mass. So it's natural for it to acquire a high mass. And it turns out the same works with the other particles. So here is my, here are my three lepton doublets, my H, my Higgs up, my Higgs down. These 24 1,2s can couple with each other. I mean, 12 of them can couple with 12 of them. These are in principle invisible because they are singlets, and this is the hidden sector. Yeah. So at this level, this is the standard model, ignoring for the moment hypercharge.
So are you excluding models where there's a particle that transforms under the standard model and the hidden sector?
Yes.
But if it had, could have a mass term?
Still, yeah. That's true. That would be a generalization, yeah. Be excluding them, yes. Mm-hmm. It turns out that the bottleneck is calculating Yukawa couplings. So you see, if we end up with too many models at the end, we can cope with, I don't know, with 100 models, but we cannot necessarily cope with 1,000 models. It turns out calculating Yukawa couplings for every different model takes a very long time on the computer, and this is why we have to kill the models as fast as we can before we go and consider the properties of decoupling. Because when we talk about decoupling, we are actually writing down a superpotential. So in string theory, we can do that, at least ignoring the coefficients. And writing down a superpotential takes some time. But I will explain that in some detail. So, these are now the 3,2 standard models, ignoring hypercharge.
Can I just go back one second
yeah?
to the previous one? So, take 6, 3-bar, 1-1.
Mm-hmm.
So you kill off two of them, well, 1 3-bar and 1 3
mm-hmm.
against one another. You're left
mm-hmm.
with the 6, 3-bar, 1, 1. So that's in addition to the standard model particle content still.
No, these are my 3 ups and 3 downs. So
for the
right hand.
Okay,
sorry, it's
U bar
and U bar. Yeah? And I only kill these. Maybe
and
I should color code them. I will color code them.
Say
yeah?
You can beat them off against one another.
The 24s I can couple to each other,
right.
But not to themselves because this coupling would vanish.
And the 3 and the 1, 2, 1s, are those coupled?
No, I mean these I can couple to each other, these. These are my leptons, these are my Higgses,
right.
These two, and these are coupled to each other.
I'm sorry, what did it say again, the one cross?
These are my leptons.
Right.
These are my Higgses.
Ah, the Higgs, okay.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And these are coupled to each other.
Okay, takes me a moment here. All right,
okay,
and
these are invisible.
All right.
Okay. So the next question is, I need to calculate hypercharge. And this was one of our motivations why we demanded that the standard model be a subset of SO10, because if we know that the standard model is an SO10...
Let me come back to that invisible statement. I mean, are there any couplings that could survive between, I don't know, say the 1, 1, 1 and some combination of Higgs fields? You could put two Higgs fields together in the superpotential...
No, there are usually couplings which are not in the standard model. But these we will get rid of by choosing the vacuum appropriately.
Choosing a vacuum. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So you're going to come back to this?
If I don't answer your question by the time I talk about giving birth to the singlet fields, then ask again.
Okay.
So I hope that I will...
Okay.
Otherwise we're anticipating, like, you know, it's something 5 transparencies later.
Okay, sure.
Okay, now I choose... You know, now I want to ask the question, okay, is this still a 3-generation standard model if I assign the particles the hypercharges? But one of our motivations to consider the standard model to be a subset of SO10 is that SO10 has a default candidate for hypercharge. So if I take SO10, break it down to SU5 cos 1 extra U1, and it turns out that, you know, we can really calculate this U1. Yeah? And also, if you break SU5 down to the symmetry of the standard model SU3 color and SU2 left, it turns out that the roots which you project out, the dual of it gives the U1 direction. So U1 hypercharge is just the dual of the root which you have projected out from going from SU5 to SU3 cos SU2. So it is very easy to get. And after we have this U1 hypercharge, we ask the question, okay, is it non-anomalous? Because in the orbifold constructions, typically half of the models have an anomalous U1, and we do not want U1 hypercharge to be anomalous because it should be a good symmetry at low energies. And this leaves us with 528 models. So in 528 cases, we can define a hypercharge coming from SU10 which is non-anomalous. And now I must re-ask the question, are these models really three-generation? So you see, 1170 of these models were three-generation when we ignored hypercharge. But now I know the hypercharge assignments of the particles, and I must ask the question, can I still have three right-handed up quarks, and also do they decouple? Let's take the same spectrum as before, and I will make a simplification, because these particles which transform under the hidden gauge probe, from the standard point of view, they are just singlets, yeah? I just see the 1-1, but I see 5 of them. So these are actually just equivalent to 40 singlets, and these are also equivalent to 40 singlets. So just for the sake of notation, I have shrunk it. I'm ignoring now the hidden sector and adding them just up to the singlets. And now it turns out, if I calculate the hypercharge values, this is still a three-generation model. So here are, one-third is the correct hypercharge for the left-handed quark doublet. I have minus four-thirds for the up quarks. I have plus two-thirds for the down quarks. I have minus one for the lepton doublets and one of the Higgses. There is the other Higgs. I have two for the right-handed electrons, and I have zero for the right-handed neutrino. And not only that I can accommodate all the particles, but I can still split them up in such a way that they can acquire a large gauge invariant mass. So I am writing this 5, 3 bar, 1 as 3 plus 2, and there are 2 anyway, with all the quantum numbers inverted. So I can write down the large gauge invariant mass term for these 2 and decouple them from the low energy theory. Then they are gone. Yeah? So I'm left with 3 up quarks. In this case, I'm left with 3 down quarks. I'm decoupling these. I'm left with 3 left-handed doublets, Higgs up and Higgs down. These can be coupled to each other, etc. Okay?
Why did you separate that longest column into a 1 and a 12?
There?
Yeah.
Here?
What's the difference between those two 1s?
No, I just wanted to, for people to make it easier to see the Higgses. Like, there's no difference. I mean, like, 3 leptons, Higgs up, Higgs down, Higgs on Higgs.
You're not coupling the two. I mean, these are the Higgses.
And it turns out, in a moment, I will even calculate B minus L. You see, there is still an ambiguity. I do not know which is the lepton doublet and which is the Higgs up, but as soon as I know B minus L, I can distinguish between them, because B minus L and Higgs is zero. So it's also nice. So I'm coming closer and closer to identifying these particles. It's a generic thing that in a string theory you end up with a bunch of particles, and then you're left with the question, what is what?
So there's nothing about the string model, though, that says when a mass term that matches two of these guys is present and when it isn't present.
Say it again.
Well, you're saying, like in the Higgs sector here that we were just talking about, you can choose to not match the middle two there with the ones, but you are going to choose to write down a mass term that puts together the two the 12s. So this is still your choice?
There are two statements. First of all, of course, the Yukawa couplings must exist for whatever I want to do. But the second thing is I can still choose refs for singlet fields given effective masses which can then, influence properties of my model. So I don't have every freedom at my disposal, but I have some freedom at my disposal. So it is not automatic that the models work. So I'm not conjuring it up. I have many non-trivial restrictions, but I also have a choice in order to better match the low energy data. So what you conclude is that this model at this level works. So we have all the standard model particles and the exotic particles, at least in a field theory sense, can be coupled to each other and made heavier and Argand. So in string theory, unfortunately, this is, you know, string theory has some more restrictions. It is not enough that it's not enough that the gauge that the mass term is gauge invariant. We have more restrictions than that, and it turns out that out of the 127 models, only 106 survive. But as you can see from the changes in the numbers, this is not a very severe restriction. So what do we have to consider in string theory? For decoupling, I've mentioned it several times by now. What we do is we take the exotic particle, which we want to decouple, times the charge conjugate particle and write a big mass term in front of it. The generic situation in string theory is, I mean, usually such low order couplings are absent, but the generic situation is that I have phi bar and a bunch of singlet fields multiplying it. And now, if the singlet fields acquire a depth, then I have an effective mass term. And the constraint coming from string theory is that these couplings must be allowed. And one string selection rule is that these couplings must be gauge invariant. This, of course, the same as in gauge theory. The second restriction is what we call H-momentum conservation. So this is something, it's a remnant of the SO10 Lorentz invariance of the string. This places also restrictions on these couplings. And the third thing is that these couplings the strings corresponding to these particles must be physically able to couple. So for example, it could be that on the orbifold they are placed in such a way that they cannot, you know, come close to each other and join and split again, which would be a string interaction. So it could be that the geometry of the orbifold forbids these particles, these strings, to couple, and in that case the corresponding coupling would also be absent. Now we cannot allow, I mean, let's say we are lucky and we have found such a term, and then we say, oh great, we give a weft to these singlets. We cannot do that in every case, because it turns out, for example, if the singlet is charged under hypercharge, and if I give it a weft, it would break U1 hypercharge. And I want to keep U1 hypercharge as a good symmetry at low energies. And this is why it is very non-trivial to show that the models decouple with the limited choice of singlets you have at your disposal. Now, the seventh criterion is that we demand a heavy top. And we demand that at least one of the interactions of the quarks is trilinear, which means that it would be non-suppressed. Because assume that there is a coupling which has the normal Yukawa coupling of the top quark, but multiplied with a bunch of singlets, from the low energy point of view, this interaction would be suppressed by the inverse mass scale, the inverse fundamental mass scale, and this interaction would be a suppressed interaction. So we say that at least for one quark, we should have a trilinear coupling, which would in some sense favor a heavy top. And next, we are addressing the question of B minus L. We identify a B minus L generator, and we are using it for R parity, and in the end for proton stability. So let me first explain how we derive the B minus L. So just as I can write down the U1 hypercharge once I know that my model lives in SO10, I could also, along the same lines, take the SO10, and take another route to the standard model, not over SU5, but over Patisalam. And it turns out that U1B minus L is exactly that part of the SU4 color which is left over after you break SU4 color down to SU3 color. So, you know, the famous paper Pati and Salam, in which they call lepton number the fourth color, that's exactly it. So if you break SU4 color down to SU3 color across AU1, this U1 will be U1 B minus L. And it turns out that this default candidate for B minus L, which lies in SO10, does not work out. So if you take this B minus L, always something goes wrong in all the models, like either you cannot match the quantum numbers of all the particles, or the B minus L generator is not vector-like. So you want to break B minus L at very low energies, because we do not observe a gauge boson corresponding to it, but we want to keep it as, you know, we do not want to break the symmetry at the string scale, which means that it should survive maybe to the scale of 10 to 14, 10 to 15. This is why we still have to require vector likeness also with respect to B minus L. And it turns out that the default method deriving it from SO10 does not work out, and how to construct the most general B minus L generator or any other abelian or discrete symmetry from E8 cos E8 is a paper in its own right, and this is the publication. So it's also a recent publication, something like 2 months ago. So this is one model in detail. So I have marked all the standard model particles in red, and all the other particles are exotics. So there is only a small glitch in the notation, so I changed the conventions, and now hypercharge is half the value I had before. Yeah. So now the lepton doublet, the quark doublet has hypercharge 1/6 and not 1/3. And the second number here in the subscriptum is now B minus L. So a quark is 1/3 of a baryon, so that is why it has the baryon number 1/3 and its lepton number 0. So B minus L is 1/3. Let's take the D quarks. The D quarks, you know, it's an anti-D quark, so it has minus 1/3 baryon number. It has no lepton number, so it's minus 1/3. And you can go through the lists. The Higgs, for example, it has no baryon and no lepton number, so it has B minus L 0. The lepton B minus L is, of course, minus 1, etc. And the identifying B minus L also helps us to distinguish what is the Higgs and what is the lepton doublet. Yeah? There is an ambiguity between the Higgses, between the up Higgs and the lepton doublets, but B minus L helps us identifying the correct Higgs.
So if we go back to that table for a moment, is there any way of getting any of the singlets to couple to the HUHD?
Yeah, generically they do.
Yeah, I can't quite follow the whole table, but
no, generically they do, but there is a very funny thing happening. Actually, when you solve the F and D term, are you worried about the mu term? Or what is
sorry?
Are you worried about the mu term or what is
well,
your
well actually I want a singlet HUHD coupling so that I avoid
these
the mu term.
Ah, yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
give the singlet some depth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's generically these couplings do exist, yes. So, oops. Okay. So what I do now is I will give special singlets thefts such that I will break B minus L, but I will break it to something useful. Let me explain that. So as before, let's pick some state. Let's say I pick the 3-bar 111 with these assignments of hypercharge and B minus L. And if I would give thefts to this particle, it would break almost every symmetry I like. Yeah, it would break SU3 color because it has some charge under SU3. It would break U1 hypercharge because it's charged under this. And it would also break here B minus L. But we can take special fields. We can take fields which are singlets under all the standard model gauge symmetries. SU3 color, it's a singlet. SU2 weak, it's a singlet. SU1 hypercharge, it's a singlet. But under B minus L, it has even charge. And if it has even charge, it turns out that B minus L is not broken into nothingness, but it is broken to a discrete subgroup, to a Z2 subgroup, which is actually R parity. And we use R parity to forbid the dimension for proton decay operators. And we have to note that this further restricts the choice of the singlet fields which we may turn on. So what I'm doing here, I'm more and more restricting the singlet fields which you can use to give WEFs and in the end decouple the exotics. So, and I have still one more restriction for these singlets. What I want to do is, I want to break all the U1s. Typically, you get many, many U1s in a string construction starting from E8 cos E8. And I also want to break all the U1s at low energies except for U1 hypercharge. And this even further restricts the number of my singlet fields. So singlet under hypercharge, even under B minus L, so that we break it to a Z2. And something generic under the other U1s, so I break them into nothingness. Yeah? And because I am so much restricting my singlet fields, I have to recheck whether the models really decouple now that I have only fewer singlets at my disposal. And it turns out that these are the singlet fields to which we can give a WEF. And there are terms of arbitrary order in the superpotential, but because, you know, I cannot write down something to infinity, so I have to cut it off at some point. What we are doing is we are using terms up to order 6 in the singlet fields. And even to this low order, allowing only for 6 singlets, we have 286,781 terms in superpotential. And we have to check that the exotics decouple. And once we have done that, we can even write down mass matrices. We can collect the fields, the terms which are quadratic in the fields cross singlets. And we have, qualitatively, we have here the mass matrices. And you can see here the heavy top, the one. And once you diagonalize, you could also get predictions for the lighter quark families. Now, the point is, this S tilde to the 5 is a symbolic expression for a polynomial. And S to the 5 is the lowest exponent. So S to the 5 would give the leading contribution from the low energy point of view. Something like S to the 7 would be more suppressed than S to the 5. Yeah. So this is why I only indicate the highest exponent here. And also, it doesn't need to be the same field. So S tilde to the 5 could be anything order 5 in these fields here. It could be chi 1 to the 2, chi 2 to the 1, chi 3 to the 1, h 1 to the 1. Yeah, this is what I mean generically by S tilde to the 5. But we know all these expressions explicitly. I mean, I just couldn't fit them on the transparency. Yeah? Okay. And now the last thing I have to check is whether the theory is globally supersymmetric. And in global SUSY, for the theory to be supersymmetric, we have to have a minimum of the potential at 0. And this is the scalar potential. And unbroken supersymmetry is tantamount to the F-terms and D-terms vanishing. Now, the D-term equations do not pose a real condition on that, but the F-term equations are much more complicated. So I have to take the superpotential, derive them by the fields, and substitute them by the BEFs, and then try to solve for the condition F equal to 0. Now, it turns out that under certain conditions, F equal to 0 implies D equal to 0. Yeah? So I'm saying that under certain conditions, because there is, of course, a theorem in the literature which says that if you're at a point where F equal to 0, you can apply a complexified gauge transformation to go to a point where you also fulfill D equal to 0. It turns out that in some pathological cases, it just doesn't work. You can write down models with only 2 fields, you know. And I went through the general proof to see what goes wrong. It turns out that one of the singlet lefts, you know, it runs away to infinity. So there is a small loophole in general argument. And also the other point which I should point out is that if you make it complexified gauge transformation, it can be a rescaling of the fields, which means that the lefts are rescaled. So of course you can then, you know, assume that this pathological case generically does not appear, and still you don't know anything about how your fields would get rescaled. So if you assume that your depth should be generically of the order of the string scale, it could be that after this transformation, you are somewhere very low, but you do not want. Yeah? But under these, under these restrictions, I can say that F equal to 0 implies D equal to 0. And we have looked at the superpotential in the singlet fields, and there are 32 polynomial equations up to order 5. And the nice thing is we can solve these equations explicitly. So there are methods in mathematics involving primary decompositions of ideals and also Gröbner bases. It is really surprising, but these equations can really be solved explicitly. And it works. So let me come to my conclusion. The standard model leaves many questions unanswered, but supersymmetric rank-unified theories are promising candidates for physics beyond the standard model. And I try to motivate why extra dimensions may solve many of the problems from which ordinary Grand unified theories suffer. And string theory is a natural candidate for the ultraviolet completion of 5 and 6 dimensional standard models, including gravity. And the models presented so far have been come closer to the MSSM closer than any of the other string constructions I've seen so far. But yet there is a still far way to go, because our models also suffer from a number of problems. So for example, it turns out that if you look at the mass matrix of the D quarks, one of the D quarks is always massless. We cannot give mass to one of the D quarks. It turns out that this is a problem with the order of the superpotential we are considering. So if you go to n equal to 8, if you go 2 orders higher, then it turns out we can give a mass to the D-term, but there is a more generic problem. There are dimension 5 proton decay operators, which we have not been able to suppress. So, and we we come to believe that this could be a problem with the geometry of the orbit force which determines the Yukawa couplings. So this is our motivation to go to the next complicated orbit force, the Z2 coset 4. Okay, thank you very much.
So let me re-ask my favorite question here.
Yes.
After you've done all of this,
yes,
there is still some surviving HUHD singlet coupling?
Actually, I don't know. I should look that up. I cannot tell you offhand, yeah. But I can look it up.
It'd be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay. Other questions?
The last point, you say the 15 model you're going to reduce more?
These 15 models, I mean, these 15 models pass all the criteria, but they have some problems like that the deep clock is massless. I mean, you know, I mean, it always depends at what level you want to kill the models. I mean, you know, I mean, many people are happy at this level, that they have something like, you know, they have the spectrum. In principle, they can decouple the exotics. They have the standard model at low energies. The closer you look, the more criteria you impose, the more difficult it is for the models to survive. So I don't, you know, many groups do not address such detailed questions like, is the proton stable? Does the deep clock have a mass? I mean, these are questions which we are asking now, and yeah. I mean, these 15 models are not fully realistic. But at least we know what is wrong with them. And we can now look for models which come even closer to the standard model. So usually, if you want to, you know, if you want to compare these constructions with other constructions, usually people come thus far. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you come to the number of models?
We wrote them down.
Look at this,
We wrote them down. We have the spectrum explicitly. The computer calculates them.
Uh-huh. So I'm asking because there's so many choices, and you can consider more.
Yeah, okay.
So do you have a general way to do this by computer or something?
There is a general way to do it. So me and another PhD student, Patrick Fautrefang in Bonn, we developed some code which calculates the spectrum of an orbit fault in 3 seconds. So you give it the shift and the Wilson lines, and out comes a human readable spectrum. Yeah, not LaTeX, it's text, but still it says 3.2, it says minus 3 for 3 bar, but it's human readable. That's one part of the, you know, of counting all the models. It turns out that it is very difficult to really go through all the choices and calculate all the models, even if it only takes 3 seconds. It turns out that if you really do only the most naive identifications in the E8 cross E8 root lattice and you want to write down all the models for all the parameter space, you spend something like 127 years. Yeah? So it doesn't work. And this is why actually one has to put in some mathematics in order to understand which models, you know, which parameter sets will lead to the same model even before you do the calculation. And in principle, what I'm doing is I'm modding out wire reflections, but depending on the gauge geometry breaking. It's a delicate way of doing it. I mean, what we do first, I mean, to write down 22,000 models, first we use a computer, but second, also some mathematics. So basically, geometry of E8 cross E8 root lattice. I mean, it's a good example for computers not being able to solve all the problems. You know, I mean, you can go up and up in speed, but sometimes you always hit a wall. I mean, still, we must use some mathematics. It's a combination between two of them.
Other questions?